We're here today to talk about ethical AI, and it's a critical topic, one which is rising in visibility within the media today. There are a number of touch points which we see each week coming out on both the responsible deployment of AI and places where people have made mistakes. And so there is a sense of urgency to understand how AI works and how we use it within our society. We're here today with an esteemed panel of Walson Lee, Jim Wilt, and Kevin Brown. Walson has recently written a book on ethical AI and how it's more of a pragmatic guide on how to think about and then implement ethical AI within your business and actually your life now. AI is touching all aspects of what we do. Jim Wilt is a subject matter expert in this area, coming from a solution architecture background. And then Kevin Brown is a creative director for the Holistics Group and will provide an interesting perspective from the creative community. Gentlemen, if I could ask you just to maybe introduce yourselves for about 30 seconds or so. Walson, why don't we start with you?
Thanks, Andrew. My name is Walson Lee. I recently retired from Microsoft after 29 years with the company. Well, in the later phase of my career, I focused on AI technology and their ethical application. Based on my project experience, I realized the importance of the AI ethic and safety, not necessarily during the project, but later on I realized that's very important. That's why I wrote a book. You can see the background, the book cover there. Emphasize the necessity of robust ethical framework to ensure the AI system develop and deploy responsibly.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful that you've written this book with a sense of moral imperative. I know one of your deep reviewers was Jim Wilt. Jim, how are you today?
Good, thank you. I'm Jim Wilt. I'm a chief architect with the Weave organization, WVE.digital. It's a eclectic group of architects worldwide that do a lot of fractional CTO work and so forth. And I've worked with Walson, I think, probably over 20 years now. We've been together, kind of hammering our heads together to make the world better through technology. And my first inroads of AI actually were in the late 80s with aerospace, and we can talk about that later. But moving on through medical systems in the early 2000s to systems that Walson and I both have worked on in parallel in the last 3 years, which are pretty exciting. And the concept of doing it sensibly and responsibly always comes up, and not everybody wants to hear that. So it's kind of good that we have this discussion now.
I agree. And then rounding out the conversation, we've got Kevin Brown. Kevin is the creative director for the Holistics Group. Kevin, can you talk a little bit about your background?
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. So I'm Kevin Brown, as Andrew alluded to. I am the creative director. I've been in technology for roughly 30 years. I was at Microsoft for about 10 years in a user experience and human-centered design role. Prior to that, I spent about 20 years in the video game industry. It is very interesting how AI has become very, very prevalent. As an artist, you can imagine, AI is something that has been a bit of a bit of an alarm. But over the last few years, I've integrated AI into my workflow, and it's something that it's a go-to. It allows for me to accelerate my conceptual phases of content creation. And it's something that we at the Holistic Group have integrated into every single aspect of what we do for our customers. So really happy to be here and looking forward to this discussion.
Thanks. Yeah, it's going to be a great discussion. So Jim, you alluded to you've been working in AI for 20 plus years, Walson, you as well. For a lot of our audience, AI has just become a topic in the last 2 or 3 years. So why is it that ethical AI matters now? What is it about the conversation that is driving you to feel this imperative to write a book?
Well, one thing is the AI technology has been rapidly advanced for the last few years. People only notice that in the last couple of years, but we working on the AI field, we know we eventually be there because of cloud and other technology investment to make that more scale much better. So the issue with that is moving so fast. And if the company just jump in and without the ethical concern or other practice in place, if the AI system causing some damage, it will be too late to mitigate the problem. So you have to be very proactive to understand and set the framework in place and all the practice in place before any issue arise. So in short, enterprise must act now because otherwise it will be too late.
Are you all seeing enterprises acting around ethical and responsible AI? I know we use those terms interchangeably. What's your experience there?
So when I was Microsoft, I noticed that the technology company are normally leading on the effort. But they know they had to be ethical and safety and other issues. So to build a trust, we talk about trust. Right. This is very important. When we talk to the different industry, they all have a different degree of kind of acceptance or recognition of importance. For example, healthcare, they recognize that's important because the ethical, medical ethical consideration always part of their training. So they understand that. But not every industry recognizes that. Financial industry is okay, but it's very. So they are lag behind from the technology perspective and also the ethical the standard perspective.
Jim, are you seeing something similar?
Yeah, there's an interesting reaction to it. And you think of it as burying your head in the sand. I'm going to ignore it and hope it goes away. And a lot of conservative organizations are taking that stance. They don't want to have to address it, so they just will have a no AI policy. And retail is a good example of that. I'm working with a retail organization that's adopting some majorly aggressive AI in the midst that they have a policy against using it. So it's interesting. So that's but that's doing it responsibly, ethically, correct? Other organizations are embracing it, and they're bolting it onto their products before they really have a knowledge of what they're doing. And this is where you see mistakes occurring. This is where you see airlines that make promises to people on their websites using their chatbots that they can't honor, and then they get sued for millions of dollars. So this is, again, why ethics matters. If I'm going to be getting into this space, but to get back to the original question you started with, Walson's good response on the aspect of why is it popular now? The advent of AI has been around a long time. The advent of generative AI, the AI in your pocket kind of a thing, where I can communicate to it directly one-on-one as a consumer, I think that's raised an awareness that these things need to be addressed now by enterprises. Before, enterprises could mask it under their machine learning AI groups, their data science decision making and analytics groups could address things more at the corporate level. Now every single person on the planet has some access to this technology, and they're getting results back that are just astounding. So the question is now gone from the concept of local area networks and corporations, which you could control, to the open internet where everybody has access. Now it's a different game. And this is where companies need to address how not only are they providing access to this information, but how are their constituents consuming this, and are they consuming it in an ethical way that won't damage them? It's a challenge. Exciting to be here now, I'll tell you that.
We're definitely not bored. Are you seeing? You mentioned that one of the companies was had a policy not to use AI. Are you seeing a lot of internal policies like that, or external regulation, or both in the market, in the various actually probably industries?
That's spot on question, because it's D all of the above essentially. I've been working a lot with the EU AI Act with a country over in Europe that's trying to put how they're going to govern and put their ethical policies in place. I'll share in a moment the epiphany they had, because it's important. In America, we don't have as much strong governance in place yet, but we do have a lot of guidance. And if you look at the NIST information and so forth that Walson references in the book, it's all guidance and it's all good practices. So because the policies are yet to be landing in the regulatory space, corporations are starting to realize we need internal policies and we need to have agility to react to these things globally, because most corporations are going to be having to follow the EU AI Act and the other acts that are in the United States and Canada. Right. And these are all right. going to be slightly different from each other and different fines. But when I was working with this one group in Europe, the CIO of the country for healthcare was struggling with, how do I deal with this in my country? And the first thing we did was get hands-on experience. Mm-hmm. And he had been working at it from, I'm going to say, a textbook approach, not down the book. The book's the great way place to start. But as Walson knows, until you get some hands-on, you really don't really understand what it's like. And once he got the hands-on experience, changed his life. And he basically said, wow, in our country, we're going to educate first, and then we're going to enforce. And I thought, smart move. Yep. And that's a lot of what you'll see, that kind of advice coming out from the book, is it's not so much about getting it right. It's about getting it and doing it right.
Yeah.
And that's a big, important part of ethical behavior.
Yeah. Yep. No, it is for sure. And I know, Walson, you wrote part of your book. Your book is more of a pragmatic approach, right? It's meant to be not just an academic treatise on ethical AI, but implementation and how do you actually roll this out, right?
Right, that's right. Yeah, the book very focused on the the key audience are the decision maker, practitioner who actually doing the project, AI project.
Continue this wonderful discussion in just a moment. We'll be back. We're going to touch on the business case for AI ethics. So why should ethics matter to businesses, and how do they capture the return on their investment for ethical AI? We're going to touch on current issues, where we're falling short and where we're finding success in responsible AI. And then we're going to touch on implementation. So what are some of the challenges and things that you can expect to see as you go to implement AI in your own business and life?
This episode is sponsored by Valuefy. Valuefy is a free tool that allows you to create business value models. Go to valuefy.net and click download to begin your valuefication journey.
All right, welcome back. Let's start with why enterprises should care about AI ethics from a business perspective. So AI has the potential to touch on both the top and bottom line for businesses, and understanding how and where they can leverage AI is going to be part of the crucial conversation they have to have and how to do that ethically. Walson, can you talk a little bit about the business case for ethical AI or responsible AI?
Sure. So ethical AI practices are not just about compliance, which is most people are thinking about the ethical AI. They are strategic differentiator. A company that prioritizes ethical AI can build a stronger brand loyalty, the trust, again, competitive edge, and avoid the hidden costs of potential legal issues. One specific study done by IBM. IBM did the return on investment study, AI ethical framework, and they found that they found some quantifiable benefits, such as the improved customer trust and reduce regulatory penalty. Trust is very important. It's very fragile, right? Because you spend so much effort. Right. Money and time to build the trust, so you can build the brand loyalty. But if you deliver an AI solution that destroys the trust with your customer, that would take a very long time to rebuild the trust. That's why I view that as one of the key reasons that the ethical AI practice is very critical.
So it's almost protecting the top line rather than doing better on the bottom line, right? So you're good, interesting.
Let me add to that because I really like the preciseness of that. And what Walson knows is I'm good at summarizing what he says smartly sometimes. If we were to look at it from a corporate perspective, using AI in an ethical way is actually presenting your products to your customers from your heart, okay? And that's a different way of thinking about it, because you're doing what's right for the customer in the most expeditious, but the most genuine way that you're doing it from a caring perspective. There are a lot of organizations that are doing it that way, and you don't know that they're using AI. That's cool, but but their products and their interfaces and their integration with customers is getting better, because actually that's using AI from your heart. There are others that are doing it from their sleeve. Those corporations, you can guess immediately, you know, who wear AI on their sleeve.
Yeah.
They promote that they have AI. They tell you how good their AI is, but they've not taken the time and rigor to embracing the best way of applying the technology to their own use cases, that you can see it's a bolt-on solution and it doesn't serve anybody, but it gets them the headline. Yeah. So from an ethics perspective, if you're looking at it, it isn't always, like Walston said, it's not about the regulatory compliance. It's often about how you're working as an organization to best service the customers you have, and doing it in a responsible way. If you follow the ethics guidelines that he's put together, you're going to see specifically how that makes you a better organization overall, as opposed to saying, I've got AI and let me show you how good I am at it, and putting it on the sales brochure.
So don't get distracted by AI. Keep your attention on your customers, and you'll find your way through this. I like that. That's great guidance, and always applicable. So regardless of the technology, that's very strong. How do businesses communicate with their customers and clients about their use of AI? Do they have a responsibility to do that, or is it something that they can use without disclosing their use of it? Wilson?
Yeah, I would recommend the customers, the company need to communicate to customer what their guidance in terms of they're using the AI, right? Because as I mentioned, they need to establish that trust.
Right.
So when people use your solution, AI solution or application, and they found a problem and they are kind of question what's your quality and others aspect out there. So you need to upfront to tell your customer what the guideline you use, what the kind of the approach you use to build a solution, and also tell them what's the proper way to use their solution.
Right. Is there a gray area around the model training data that's used? Do they have a responsibility to talk about that, since that's a vector for bias to be introduced into a system? And I also want to hear from Kevin on this, because that's a topic for creators as well, right? When their intellectual property is used to train these. So first question though is a responsibility to talk about how bias is managed in your system or through the training data?
That let me start that conversation, then Kevin and Jim Park can jump in. So the training data, because they are from AI, current AI, generative AI, there are two parts. One is a foundational model, which is built by the technology company, like the OpenAI and Google and others. They are foundational model, provide the large language model, and then drive in some of the answer and the customer have. The other model or other AI algorithm model, which the company can build their own based that their own internal or proprietary information, or I call the knowledge base, which is their unique value they build on top of that, right?
Yeah.
Because they know their business processes, they know the business problem very well, how to solve the problem, and how to certify the customer requirements and all kind of stuff. And this is a unique element out there. Now, depending on how they use that, they need to say, here's what we base the data or whatever that we build our own internal model. And they can also need to be transparent. In the book, I talk about transparency. In terms of how they train their data, they don't use the personal data or whatever. That they should stay upfront about that, so their customer know, okay, how you train your model.
Yeah, So an awareness of intersection with other privacy-related laws,
That's
things
right.
like that. Yep. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Good. All right, Kevin. How about from the side of a creator, and what's your feeling? And actually, maybe Walson, you as well. Your book may now be used to train AI models. So there's always a question of both maybe the style appropriation. So certainly in art and music and those that. Style can be picked up as part of that training data. There's the voice and tone, and that's usually done without any meaningful compensation back to the creator. Is that the path forward, or are there other, you know, what's your sense now? And Kevin, why don't you start us off on the discussion?
Yeah, so that's a fascinating and an excellent question, because mm-hmm. the technology is outpacing sort of the traditional laws, right? You'd have mm-hmm. trademark and you'd have copyright infringements, right? Or likeness challenges that you may, you know, use a celebrity. And now with AI, you could generate something that looks fairly believable without any permission and or cooperation from, say, someone that you've used, their voice likeness, their image. You can put those things together pretty quickly and use them. And the copyright laws right now are catching up, but they're not quite there. Mm-hmm. My take on it is, and this is more sort of from a personal perspective, as the technology catches up, if you're doing something that's nefarious currently, right, with non-ethical uses of it, it's going to catch up with you, right? You may mm-hmm. get away with it for a while, and maybe the copyright laws or the infringement laws aren't quite there, but it will catch up with you. So using ethics on how you apply these, this technology and these advancements, and they're coming at us at light speed, it's always going to be err on the side of caution. Use the sort of traditional where I can't use the brand, I can't embellish something to get a likeness. Those are probably still the tried and true sort of guidelines or guidance that I would recommend using. But again, the technology is moving very, very fast. We're seeing things in the market at light speed, and it's very hard to distinguish, you know, have they actually got the rights to use this before you see it? Right. And it's opening up opportunities for, you know, direct marketing opportunities and specific use cases that they can drive that might later, you know, in a few years from now, maybe even a few months, be very, very obvious that this was an infringement, and you will have lawsuits ensued at some point. So I'd err on the side of caution, always do things ethically.
So, it's an interesting conversation. We've hit on a couple of points I want to summarize for our audience. One is the pace of change has increased. Things are moving really quickly. I think, Walson, you called this out. The pace of policy is lagging the pace of change. So that we've got a pretty big gap where the rules and regulations aren't in place to guard against intentional or unintentional ethical issues. And so, Kevin, I think your point is working with an ethical framework allows us to move forward without those rules in place, but still have a meaningful way to deploy this. So I think we've already hit on a sweet spot, and the fact that Walson's book sits right in the middle of this, which is a pragmatic guide on how do you actually implement ethical AI, your timing is perfect. But let's talk about where there are challenges, where we're falling short on AI ethics. There have been a number of examples. I think, Jim, you mentioned one, which was an airline that had an AI bot that promoted a certain price, and they were found they had to honor that price. So what your AI says for you, you are accountable for that as an organization. That's a huge precedent, and there have been others. We've had recent AI pricing questions where some airlines are pricing things using AI that may allow them to avoid issuing low prices and artificially inflate prices. So there's a lot of concerns and trust that's being lost, and transparency opportunities that are missing. In your book, Walson, you talk about a number of challenges in this area, one of which you talk about is ethics washing. Can you just describe what ethics washing is for our audience and maybe talk a little bit about the challenges it's introducing?
Yes, ethics washing is mean that company, they advertise, they are doing the ethical AI. Mm-hmm. It's only on paper, basically. And that happened a lot.
Sleeve, like Jim said.
Yeah, a lot of company I talked to when I was Microsoft, they all said, we do ethical AI. We follow your responsible AI framework. Mm-hmm. But the problem is they don't have actual practice in place mm-hmm. or monitoring or assurance about the follow up the framework and actually implement that in their AI solution. Mm-hmm. And you saw the recommendation, a practice I recommend in the book, such as transparency. You talk about transparency, just like a recent AI defined the price based on AI without human in the loop to validate that or, mm-hmm. or tell the customer about what the rule they use or what the AI model they use to generate our response.
Right.
As long as you explain very well, that's why we have another thing called explainability, just meaning that when you build an AI, you need to have AI to explain how they come to the conclusion and how they come to that recommendation. It's a very difficult task today, even today, but you should make effort to explain what decision come from, right? Whether you based on this source of data or whatever the result coming from, and that will help customer to understand how you actually generate this solution.
Right. What are we seeing? So you talk about enforceable safeguards. Both those safeguards could be internal safeguards, depending on the nature of the company. They could be externally enforced. What does that external enforcement or regulation look like across the different markets in the world? I know there's a lot of change here in the U.S. as we've just kind of announced that we'll be regulating on a state-by-state basis. How is the state of regulation and enforcement in AI?
Well, I think Jim mentioned the EU AI Act, which is a more mm-hmm. probably leading of everybody else in terms of the comprehensive nature of the regulation requirement, everything like that. So everything I mentioned in the book, a lot of material actually come from that EU AI Act, because it basically addressed how the company should address that, because you want to focus on European market, you have to address that. Now, mm-hmm. in US, they used to have a couple regulation requirements in place. However, it's not being enforced right now. But you can see there's a lot of demand in terms of, hey, we should put some regulation in place. My only concern is, as you say, if state by state, that's a problem, because it's very hard to keep up with the regulation like that. Mm-hmm. For example, work on a project on the determine the state tax, and also the healthcare policy is varied by state. So, for example, when you become you want to be certified as a doctor or have a license, every state have a different regulation, which is very difficult. That's why the pharmacy and the other healthcare they spend a lot of effort to do state by state. That's my concern in the U.S. because there's no comprehensive and coherent the AI regulation in place, unlike the EU AI app. Jean, you want to, because you are very familiar with that.
Throw some color into this, because what Kevin said earlier, really, if you have nefarious behaviors, mm-hmm. They're going to come out eventually, whether there's regulations or not. And I come from an experience of that, not that I've done nefarious behaviors that any of you know about, but in my early aerospace days, my company was fined, the largest fine at the time in the history of the world, mm-hmm. for unethical behaviors. It was an aerospace organization where a few bad actors mm-hmm. made it bad for everybody. And we all had to go through ethics training. And in the ethics training, the bottom line was, if you think something's wrong about some behavior or some way of operation, it probably is wrong and you need to speak up. And I think that gets to the bottom line of, if you're dealing in an ethical intention in the onset, you're going to be probably covered by the best of practices. Something Walson said, I think, is clear to the concept of this behavior, and that would be transparency. If you're logging all of the thought patterns that your AI is using to come to a conclusion, so that you can go back and look at it to see if it was aligned with the laws of the land, you're better off doing that, even if it captures that you're breaking some new law that didn't exist at the time, only because you have that transparency. To Kevin's point, if I'm doing a nefarious activity, I'm not going to have transparency bit turned on. It's going to be turned off.
Right.
So blockchain is a good precursor to this concept of changing the way we operate by transparently showing everything we're doing. And you see it in the Gen AI models today. Often you can get a complete trace back as to how it put its response together.
Right.
We all should be doing that with our software, and we should have been doing that 20 years ago, including today.
Right.
But it's good that it's coming to fruition now.
Yep. Yeah, especially as we move from rules-based programming to these non-deterministic systems.
Yes.
It's harder to do. One topic that we touch on, or you touch on in the book, Walson, is you know, the bias that creeps in and the impact of that bias on the models. And an ethical framework sounds like it might be that way, back to, you know, even if you aren't sure of the bias that exists in your data, having an ethical deployment can help you with that. Is that, or help you mitigate bias in your data? Is that a fair summary?
Right. It's a good summary. A little bit more complex than that, because
sure,
the bias can happen in different layer. It can be in the foundational model, which will happen all the time, as everybody know that, because when the technology company build a foundation model, they use a vast data set from internet or from any publicly available source. They couldn't validate every source per se.
Mm-hmm.
So that bias can be there. It can be your own company data can create a bias, which is all happen quite frequently.
Right.
It can be other way in your design in terms of the algorithm you use and other AI model you use that will create bias. There are a couple way to prevent that. There are some AI tool to help you detect the bias, because the bias is so common, actually, very common, actually. So you can be more proactive that look at the data there. We talk about data and knowledge difference there. You want to find a reliable knowledge base versus some data unreliable. Then you also, during the design phase, you need to interject some of the monitoring of the bias tendency, because you can use your result compared with, I call the population kind of set of the result.
Right.
So you have a benchmark that there's a lot of benchmark to detect the bias. And in this way, it's a complete loop. So you have to find the foundational data and also your design process to do that in conjunction with the human in the loop, because human need to do auditing and look at the result to see any bias that happened there.
You've used that term human in a loop a couple of times now. Can you give our audience a quick kind of overview as to what you mean by that and how it's applicable to ethical AI?
So human in the loop is very important, the approach in the AI development.
Mm-hmm.
So as we mentioned, AI had to be trained, right? AI, you had to teach AI to understand the data, understand the whole thing, the knowledge, and they can produce a good result. So human is in the loop initially. So when they build the data, we normally call labeling the data, meaning that they label the data, have an expert to look at the data and label that. That's first phase of human in the loop.
Yeah.
There are human in the loop in other stages, even during the design and development process. You got a human to take a look on the different stages of result. I still remember the day I built my first big commercial grade AI solution. We actually have to look at the result on every state, every night, every day, actually, because the model change and the data change. So we had to monitor that. And the final step of the human in the loop is to have a domain expert to look at the output and compare with what they know should be the right answer. For example, in healthcare, if you do it as a diagnostic, you might need a very seasonal and senior doctor to look at the result. And based on all the information, the medical record, everything about the patient, and to compare that result from AI to the human expert.
Human. Mm-hmm.
And that's why when we talk about accuracy, we're not talking about accuracy in the tool itself, but accuracy compared with the domain expert. Okay. Right. So this is a human rule in a different level. All
right. So, Walson, you were talking a little bit about the process of taking data and labeling it and then getting that into the model so that it can be used by the model, where it's then checked again. One of the topics that comes up is the exploitation of labor in that AI kind of supply chain from that early tagging of data and labeling of data. What is that topic, and then how is that being addressed from an AI, particularly in the foundation or frontier models?
Right. So a company like OpenAI or Google, they when they start training the foundation model, they need to hire a lot of people who do the tagging or labeling of the data. Also the categorization of the data, because they need to categorize this article from whatever the newspaper part of this part of the knowledge tree, what we call the knowledge tree. That's very labor intense, but they hire people. I heard they hire a lot of people with the probably minimum wage, a lot of part-time work. So so this is the issue that's been discussed for quite a while, because they kind of use cheap labor to do this kind of work. Now, there are other efforts going on. So this is just a starting point. And then they can also, based on the initial result, they can build a simulation data or synthesize data set. So it's very easy to do that and then and keep adding the data into their training set data. Nowadays, it's more automated. So in the initial labeling and then do that kind of stuff. So this is the, this is the issue that also, the other issue is the privacy concern. When they do this process, they don't, sometimes they don't honor the copyright other issue, right? This has been ongoing debate and legal challenges about that. This is another problem that happened right now. So without the very clear regulation or kind of the consensus of how to solve the problem, I think this issue will keep going on for a while.
Yeah. And I think that's pretty close to the intersection with the challenges we see in the creative community, right, Kevin, with either attribution or lack of attribution and style appropriation. What are you seeing in your world?
Yeah, well, there's a lot happening in our world in the creative space, as we know. There's certainly almost a horse race with a lot of tools. Sora's doing some pretty amazing things with animation. We're seeing those starting to show up in the market. And they're allowing for, things that would have traditionally been very, very difficult to pull off in a CGI capacity. With AI and certain tools like Sora, you're able to expedite that pretty significantly. And where we're seeing a lot of opportunity with AI in the creative space is to build things out really quickly, to comp up a scene or to sort of build out a storyboard of something and be able to do that really quickly to assess it, to make sure, see if it's viable to invest a lot of time, a lot of people and a lot of money to actually build that out. Those are, areas that are very, very ripe for creativity. We're also seeing the acceleration of certain workflows. Like, for example, in a product like Photoshop, Firefly is the AI sort of plug-in or adaptation of that particular tool, which has been a staple in the creative industry for, 30, 40 plus years, 30 years. I'm not going to exaggerate, 30 years. But what it's allowing artists and artisans to do is to do a lot of the sort of menial and sort of
drudge work.
Those yeah. tasks that typically will take a long time. You're able to do those really quickly, and it allow you to experiment. And artists really love sort of the opportunity to try something out and fail before investing a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of passion to find out that it actually doesn't really work. So it's really expediting yeah. sort of, you know, yeah. the creative workflow and path to getting to decisions from a creative standpoint, you know, evaluations, approvals, and all those kinds of things in the commercial space much quicker. It's accelerated the content creation process overall.
And where do you feel on the, in terms of the attribution for use of art as training data? Is that come up in your daily work?
Yeah, so I'm going to use a little bit of a personal commentary here. Mm-hmm. You know, as an artist, as a creative, somebody who's done work in this space for, you know, decades, I was a little nervous about it using my images, my content, my assets to sort of train and then ultimately, you know, probably even enhance the things mm-hmm. that I do. But I've grown, quite frankly, over the last couple of years to not only embrace that, feel quite honored if I find something that has a sort of flair or style that I typically use, I'll find that as a, you know, a pat on the back, right? Mm-hmm. Because quite frankly, there's nothing really new under the sun. Artists have always borrowed images, borrowed, you know, photographs, yeah. things for inspiration, and then maybe enhance them to create something that's your own. AI's allowed for that to really accelerate. And so I don't, you know, again, this is personal. I was very cautious, very nervous about how it was going to be used. But now I see it as like, you know, it is it's appropriate, right? I'd love to think that it's appropriate to use the world of content to sort of generate something that could be uniquely mine, but I'm mm-hmm. leveraging AI versus having AI just create something. Right. So, again, that's a personal take on it. Yeah. But that's sort of where I am right now. Things may change.
Yeah, no, but, I think it's, it's an Andrew, ongoing journey.
Let me add a story to complement what Kevin said. So look at the cover design of the book. I started some concept design. And I tried using AI to generate some image. Mm-hmm. And I get Kevin to come out more kind of human touch of the whole design. Yes. And he actually bring a lot of thought in terms of how to make this cover design more suitable for the book. And then also unique, showing the unique value of that. It's a combination of human and AI together, which is exactly the theme of the book.
Perfect.
You can see that.
Yeah. AI creates amazing creative briefs, right? So what Walson has just described, he, mm-hmm. as the author, was able to create a creative brief with images to allow for someone like myself, an illustrator, to take it from there, really understand what he's looking for, and build on it, enhance it. So there, that level of communication from a creative standpoint was spot on. And what we ended up as a finished product was something that we were very, very both proud of.
Yeah, interesting. And I think that's the collective idea that AI is better to augment human capabilities rather than replace them. So good. I did want to talk briefly, though, about one of the other maybe imperatives is the environmental impact from AI. And this is kind of at the ethics, extending that. I think you in your book call it extending ethics to our planet. Can we talk a little bit about the environmental impacts of AI and why is that even a topic? So for our audience, why is there even a consideration of environmental impact for AI? And Jim, I know you've spent a lot of time in this area. Do you want to kick this discussion off?
Sure. Yeah. Just 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, I was at the in London for the kind of a green IT week that they had. Mm-hmm. And I was participating in ICE's Sustainable Architecture Conference. It was an all-day mm-hmm. event. And there's a lot of interest and impact on the use of power, electricity, and carbon footprint and water usage, especially with the GPUs being used and so forth around the concept of the popularity of AI growing at an exponential rate. And there's a lot of serious concern around that. And I don't have the exact numbers off the top of my head, but they're kind of along the lines of, take a look at cloud and data centers today. That's probably about 3 to 4% of the power grid consumption. If you look at the office that Kevin's in right now, they're part of 40% of the consumption. And if you look at your home that all of us are in, it's about 20%. And these are round numbers, they're not accurate. But that's the differentiation between the costs of using AI and the footprint to the global environment versus that of other aspects in our lives. Now, to put it in perspective, I couldn't be happier that there's an emphasis on being concerned about it, even at the 3 to 4% level, because that means we're attacking it head on before it becomes a reactive problem that we cannot fix. We're actually being very conscious about it today. The fact that organizations are using different forms of computing distributed that are actually both better for ethical use and better for green footprint use is amazing. Probably some numbers we don't realize are along the lines of the most abusive would be our own private data centers. They're the least efficient. Cloud comes in as highly efficient because they're all conscious about it.
Yep.
But you can't take your workloads and move them to just cloud. You have to think about the use of the workload and where it's best managed. Something we haven't talked about, and I think it's something that Wilson and I both have a passion for, is the edge. The edge is where you're greenest at this point. It's also where most data exists, is in the edge. Yeah. Quality data, I should say, exists in the edge. And so I think as we move forward and we address the concerns, that pendulum could swing out of control at any time. But at this point in time, it's in control. We're conscious about it, and we're actively pursuing green computing around ethical AI usage. It's really working quite well for us at this point in time. But at any moment, it could get away from us.
Can you talk a little bit about the edge? Only just describe that as a concept. I know some people may not be familiar with that as a concept. And then tie that back to your point about, I think, data lives at the edge and why that's important to us.
So great question, because nobody ever really talks about the edge. It's kind of one of those enigmas, right? I'll use a good example of Netflix, just to make it down to earth for everybody. When you're watching Netflix and you're being suggested a movie that they think you might like, you have to realize they're using the edge for that. The movie is not streaming from the cloud, just so you know. The movie is streaming from your local ISP, where it's stored, so they can scale to every household in the world, so to speak. So yes, it's there in the cloud. If you pick a movie that's not at the ISP, you'll notice the lag, that little circle rotating. And eventually you start watching it. Okay, well, I had to move the movie down to your ISP to get it so that you can watch it. So that's the edge, is getting what you want most near you and suggesting what's near you to most people.
Okay.
So if I'm watching a Disney movie, and I'm in the same ISP as Walson, he's going to get that Disney movie suggested to him because it's already there.
It's already
and
there.
I don't have to download anything. It's cost conscious. It's also quite relative to better use of resources. Now, if we take it to medical and medical devices, if I have a heart monitor or even a device like I'm wearing monitors, you know, your health, things like that. At this point, the edge is my phone. My device is talking to the phone. It can be chatty because it's a close connection, and it's just a Bluetooth connection. It can be chatty, and that doesn't cost anything. But if my watch is talking directly to the cloud with a chatty interface, it would be highly inefficient. It would use a lot more electricity, a lot more battery. When I was in telecom, One of the things we realized is how we write software on our mobile devices, you want them chunky because you don't want that connection back and forth. It costs the battery in your device to go down. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not green either. If your battery has to be charged more often, you're increasing your carbon footprint.
Right.
All these things come into play.
How do we talk to business leaders about what role they can play in this? So it sounds like certainly from an architecture perspective and for the frontier models, how they collect and source their data and the nature of the model. How do business, is it a matter of intentional thought, or what's your guidance to business leaders about this?
That's a great question, Andrew. I thought about that in the book. I actually a whole chapter about that for the leadership.
So read Walson's book. Got it. That's the answer.
Yeah. Well, there are a couple of areas. Let me highlight that. So the business leader, the first thing they need to do is set the vision and direction for the AI initiative, not just the ethical AI, but the entire AI initiative they want to do in their organization, right? And ethical AI practice must be part of that, because you cannot just have AI initiative without the ethical stuff. The second key responsibility for the leadership is the resource allocation, right? Once they set the vision and direction, they need to allocate the resources necessary, including financial, human, expert, and other, to drive the initiative they have. The next one is a very important one, which is typically being ignored, is the culture and accountability. Because we touched a little bit about our culture, but I want to emphasize that leadership is very, very important to foster the culture of accountability and transparency within the organization. Right? Without the accountability and transparency, you probably don't have the ethical AI in place. You probably put the AI ethical framework on paper, but you do need to drive the accountability and transparency. Right. This is require a lot of effort, right? To set example, have training, have the standard, and other stuff to make that happen.
Okay.
And the next responsibility for leadership is the stakeholder engagement. So this is become important, but they do that day to day. But from the AI ethical perspective, they need to talk to the various stakeholders, including employee, customer, regulatory, and other community, to understand what's impact, what would be the expectation they have. And I don't see that do that today, by the way. This is the area is very weak today. They, for example, the airline, they decide to do the AI-based pricing without talk to their customer, to get a sense of their customer, right? This area need to some improvement. And lastly is a continual improvement. Right, we talk about the framework, everything like that. We talk about foster the transparency and the accountability. But continuing improvement is important, because this is the changing very rapidly. The AI landscape changes very rapidly. Regulatory compliance also changes very quickly. Almost every week we have the news about that. So the leadership need to take the knowledge that and monitor what's going on within their organization, also outside their organization, talking to their stakeholder, and continue improve and revise their strategy. As I mentioned, this should be part of their overall business strategy. This is an AI ethic and should be part of their strategy if they decide to go for it.
Visible advocacy. Continue
improve. It will be a continual improvement cycle there. So that's my two cents in terms of how leadership should do.
I think it's more than two cents, Walson. Thank you. Yeah, no, that's very, very well said. Very well said. Let's talk a little bit about the implementation as we get towards closing up. You touch on a number of concerns or challenges that businesses and individuals face when they first start to work with AI and implementing it. And we've touched on some of the bias problems that come with data. What are some of the other challenges with data? I think you used the term dirty data. Can you talk a little bit about what dirty data is?
Right. So the dirty data, meaning that when you collect the data already hidden somewhere, they have not been validated. They've been not been normalized or other areas. So there are a lot of become the data quality issue. That's very common. It's even prior to the AI. But once you talk about AI, the data quality has become very important. In the other aspect, we talk a little bit about the difference between the data and the knowledge, right? So you got a ton of data. Every company has a lot of databases somewhere. But the knowledge is different. Knowledge is the insight or the intellectual property you have to drive your business process. That's right. Your know-how. That's the key to your survival of your company. Mm-hmm. You need to understand that, because I work on a couple AI projects. It took the client a while to understand how important I'll extract the knowledge from the vast the database they have, right? It took a while. And once they know that, then right. We can capture that knowledge. We capture the knowledge in the knowledge base and use that to validate the result from the AI solution, right? Because this is important. You want your AI recommendation or solution that can address your business need. Hmm. And your business need, you capture in somewhere that you need to extract that knowledge. So right. that's why the data quality and knowledge-based approach is very critical to get that right.
So I want to highlight just real quick, please. Something, mm-hmm. It's just an anecdotal, but it's meaningful anecdotal. At one time, Walson and I were simultaneously working on using medical data to try to do AI insights around that. One of us was working on an organization that was trying to do patient diagnosis or help in patient diagnosis. And because of the data quality, the best confidence one of us could get was 80% confidence. Mm-hmm. And that's not something you're going to use to diagnose someone. So right. There's a use case where dirty data is going to be problematic. And we can spend years, if not decades, trying to get our data clean. And so another use case that one of us was working on was not diagnosis of patients, but for an insurance organization, identifying of all the employees, of all their medical records, are there specific patients that are subject to expensive procedures? And if so, we can adjust our rates accordingly. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a different use case. 80% mm-hmm. confidence there is pretty good.
Right. Pretty good, yeah.
Yeah. So again, it's interesting that you have to work within the bounds of what you've got. You've got dirty mm-hmm. data in all situations today, no matter what. Right. And we're making it dirtier every time we manually type something in. I'm sorry, but we are. So as we try to decide how are we going to work with the data we have, we have to make conscious decisions around what I'm going to do with the outputs of that data. And if I'm getting 80% confidence, I'm not going to diagnose anybody. But I am going to use it internally, maybe to make better decisions about different things, like insurance rates for an organization that might have 5 outliers that could cost the company dearly if they don't prepare for it. And am I breaking ethical laws if I don't share who those patients are? These are all questions that need to be answered. And I think if you have a good ethics basis, you'll know exactly how to answer them by the book, so to speak.
Yeah.
But that is something that was interesting, because here we were doing the exact same type of AI work in 2 different organizations, but 2 different use cases.
Right.
One, it was not quite good enough, but better. One, it was perfectly good enough. And that's understanding them. What can I get out of my data, and how am I going to leverage it? And I think there's a problem with AI today, consuming, in the sense that we have the hype that's out there, and everybody wants to build products to the hype, not to the realities. But when you've been deep into the realities of it, like Walson and I have, and I know Kevin as well, you have a high respect for working with what you've got.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting discussion, and certainly for some of those higher stakes solutions that you're putting in place, that transparency and understanding your data, where it's come from, and the quality of it is even more critical. I want to go back, and Walson, you talked a little bit about the distinction between data and knowledge, and in your book you talk about knowledge-centered design. Much of the audience is almost certainly heard of human-centered design as a kind of a mindset or approach to keeping humans at the center. Can you talk a little bit about knowledge-centered design and why it's important for this topic, and maybe briefly how it relates to human-centered design?
Right. So the knowledge-centered design is based on human-centered design, right? Human-centered focus on the need and the interaction with the human. So put a human in your design approach. Now, what I thought with the knowledge-centered design is important for the AI, because as I talk about the to input accuracy, avoid some problem like hallucination and other problem that generated by the foundational model, you need to put a reliable knowledge, I call it a knowledge base, to validate the result from either from the foundational model, other AI algorithm, or other model you produce. And this knowledge needs to be validated. Now, when we talk about validation of knowledge, you can validate with your domain expert, or you can validate with your user of the system. And normally you do both. Like the system I build, the same healthcare system I build, which is in production right now, is both, right? So you need to, the knowledge comes from many different sources, right? That when we talk about diagnosis, doctor will be a primary source. But remember, the patient's him or herself is also a reliable source.
Yeah.
And also the other caregiver, like nurse and other caregiver, they also provide a source. So these are the knowledge combined can help understand the patient overall well-being, and not just one diagnosis or one disease. This is the lesson I learned after working that whole year on the project. Realize the patient is the center of that.
Yeah.
And then we got other kind of other also close to the center, like doctor and nurse, other caregiver and other people who care that per the patient. So the knowledge base is looking at that whatever human that you need to, the human type of problem you need to solve, and in conjunction with the typical human-centered design approach, like we have a several design principles, that design thinking and is part of that, and many other approach, that you inject the knowledge from the different domain expert plus the patient is themselves, right, to understand what they really need, what a consequence, what the environment. So we talk about bigger picture here, and use that to build your knowledge database, and then use that to validate your result. So that is the concept of the knowledge-based design approach.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because we've sat here, we've been on for an hour now, and we're talking about a deeply technical topic, you know, artificial intelligence, and yet we keep coming back to the human side of it. And I know you've said transformation's 95% people and 5% technology. And I think that we're kind of landing on the ethical, the answer to the ethical AI imperative is going to be human driven. It's not going to be a technology solution. So. All right, welcome back, and thank you to the panel for a wonderful, engaged discussion on ethical AI and how do we implement AI responsibly, both within organizations and within society at large. And I think we're quickly seeing that this is not a problem that's going to have a technical solution, but it'll be one where humans need to change the way they think and work with the tool and each other. So to wrap it up, I'd like to go through and talk with each of you about what your perspectives are on, or what guidance, what final points you would have to give to anybody who's approaching AI from either a personal perspective or, more importantly, potentially deploying it for a large number of other people. So whether it's an organization or a product that they're developing, what guidance and tips do you have for them to do that in a responsible and ethical way? Kevin, I'm going to start with you.
Well, my guidance would be use it, right? I think there is a notion that it is, you know, I'll use the term the boogeyman, right? It's here to destroy humans. Mm-hmm. But no, it's here to really enhance, from my perspective, creativity, allow for you to do things from an experiential as well as experimentation capacity. So use the tools. They're available. There's tools like Canva right now that is really making strides, allowing for novice to get in and to create content, images, resumes, PowerPoints, what have you. And it's really accelerating. It's really exciting to see that capacity really come to the forefront. From professional artists, really use it. It's going to accelerate your workflow. It's going to allow for you, again, to experiment, try things to really nail that sort of creative expression.
Introducing the Valuification of Things, your one-stop podcast on discussions of value, especially business value. This forum features host Sri Sundram, who discusses how to quantify value for practically any scenario. You'll hear business leaders and subject matter experts give firsthand accounts of their value journey. Available today on your favorite podcast platforms.
One of the things that I really enjoy doing is bringing things to life in terms of maybe just having a simple image. I can bring that into a tool like Sora. I can animate it from there. I can bring in replications of voices and create something so quick that I can really get a feel for it and double down, continue to build on it, or scrap it and try something different. So my advice to everyone out there, from a novice to professional, use the tools. Get very familiar with those tools. You will create something that is absolutely amazing. But at the same time, applying the ethical framework, don't try to sell something that's not yours. Really advocate and celebrate the tools, right? So I think at the current state of the evolution of AI and the way it's sort of integrated into the creative space, use them, love them, and get out there and create.
Don't believe the fear or the hype. Use it and find out yourself. I love it. I love
Absolutely.
It. Jim, how about you? What kind of guidance would you give to, say an executive who's looking to leverage AI across his business processes?
I'm going to play off of Kevin's start because it's a great start.
It was.
If you're not playing with it, you're not learning what you can do and can't do with it. And so if you're an executive, you're probably responding to the hype. You can't learn everything from a Gartner conference. You have to be hands-on, even at the executive level, and you can be, to the point that you have an appreciation for what the technology does and what it can't do. And then the best thing an executive can do today is get out of the way of their constituents, of their employees. Most organizations that put policies in place to stifle is out of fear, is what they won't say, but they will say it's out of a fiduciary responsibility to our customers.
Right.
The reality is there's so much that you can do internally with public data that has no harm to anybody other than learning yourself, that you're going to miss out on then. Organizations that allow their employees to play with the technology are the ones that are surfacing already at the top of the mark. And that's kind of cool, but they're not the people you would think should be. A lot of the organizations that you think should be at the top are running from that fear perspective. To Kevin's point, play, and then build a use case after you played.
I love it. Thank you. And so yeah, to bring it back to your earlier comments on culture, the officers of a company are uniquely positioned to do that. And it sounds like you're saying active and visible advocacy from them is critical. I love it. Walton, I know you've written a book on this, so you've got quite a lot to say here. In your book, you talk about three guiding principles. I don't think we've touched explicitly on them yet. Can you walk us through what those principles are and how they help us get to an ethical AI world?
Sure. So in the book, I recommend three guiding principles for set out the AI ethical framework because exactly need to something to get started, right? So this is a kind of the baseline or foundation to get started, and they can customize or adjust based on their enterprise strategy and others business. So the first guiding principle is human first metric. Meaning that whatever the AI solution you build, it should not harm the human, or whether it's the content you produce or result you produce or action or recommend action, it shouldn't harm the human or the society as a whole. So this is very important. That's what I call the first guiding principle.
Right.
The other guidance for kind of, so the first one over they have priority over the other guidance for the, whatever you build, you cannot harm the human. That's first important one. The second guiding principle is the ethical imperative, meaning that you need to define your own enterprise, the guidelines in terms of what ethical objective you have, how what's the boundary of your solution should be. And it depends on what area you want to focus on in the AI solution you want to build. But this is the second very important guiding principle that you need to define, who is the majority of work are your ethical framework or your the team are going to working on. The third guiding principle is the responsible mandate. Basically, there are two parts of this guiding principle. One is you need to avoid the bias or any unethical result of your output.
Right.
And this we talk about the technique to prevent the bias and others. The second part of this guiding principle is the in order to do that, the AI solution itself had to protect itself, right? So it had to ensure there are different component, whatever the AI model you use, are reliable and then they can trust that. So we talk about trust, that implies all the way to internal our AI solution in order to produce that good result. So these are the three key guiding principles that I would recommend the exactly to take action on that.
Yeah, it certainly feels like there's parallels with Asimov's laws of robotics, right?
Right. Also, it's actually is a good point that I started look at the Asimov, the three robotic guiding principle. But there are a lot of research where I write in the book. There's a lot of current AI research focused on how to modernize that three guiding principle into the current world of AI. So these three guiding principles are kind of repurpose the original three guiding principle to fit into the AI world and also think about future a little bit. Because people will think, why do we still have a human first mechanism, right?
Because
the generated AI, the AGI is not too far away, right? So you think about AGI, it's almost like a robot with a unlimited human intelligence or can exceed the human intelligence. So you have to think about when you build AI, and this has become a hot topic. I just saw the news in the last couple of days because OpenAI just announced the 5.0 release. And the 5.0 is a stepping stone to that AGI. It's the very strong in terms of the reasoning. We call it reasoning engine. And can have a thinking process very similar to the human how humans solve the problem, which is a step toward that generate the intelligence.
Can you define AGI for our audience real quick?
Yeah, AGI. What AGI mean is the AI solution one day can have the similar intelligent capability as a human.
Okay.
In different area, there's a different definition of AGI right now because it's a debate in the industry. Because you look at the coding,
right?
It's getting close, right? I think Satya, the Microsoft CEO, talked about 30% of the code produced by AI. That's this year, but it will expect that keep getting better and better. And the file, I just noticed that I saw the article that they are getting much better than 30%. They're probably 50% whatever ratio. So you think about the very rapid advancement of the AI. So file is today, 2025. You think about 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, or 20 years from now. At a certain point, there are different people have different idea in terms of timeline. From 2 or 3 to all the way to 25 or 30 years or 30, even longer. We don't know when can we reach AGI. I think they still need a couple of breakthrough to get there. Even so, though Walson, there's a lot of hype today.
You need to then bring in your fourth principle, your fourth guiding principle, or the zero principle that you call it.
Zero guidance. Jim, great point. Zero guidance or zero one is very important. So Asimov, when he put a three guiding principle and realized there's the zero should oversee out of all three.
All them.
A zero means that whatever you build should be applied to the whole humankind, right? Mm-hmm. Not individual, because we talk about human first. It normally is a smaller scope, either your customer or something like that, or your stakeholders. But zero law is meaning that whatever you build, you shouldn't impact the whole humankind. And this leads to the AGI or human or super AI, which doesn't mean that one day the AI can exceed in the human intelligence. And worry about the AI can take over the whole world and destroy the humankind, which is a very concern, right? So that's why some people say this is your role becoming important, because you need to put some safety measurement today. Yep. And there's a lot of debate in terms of how the AI, the foundational provider, they don't put enough safety measurement there, which is from our side, we are consumer of that foundation model, need to be aware, because not every result they produce can potentially harm the humankind.
Right.
So this is be aware, and a company need to be aware, need to think about that. So whatever they build, they cannot just take the face value out of the foundation model. They need to put something in place.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you, thank you. So let me quickly try to summarize this deep, deep discussion. It sounds like we are in alignment that ethical AI is, there is an imperative to focus on it now. We can't wait, because if we wait, then it'll be too late, almost by definition. And the solution is going to come from human intention, not from a technical solution. And that's going to drive that, or that human intention, we should be around leveraging AI transparently, understanding how the models are trained, how the data is turned from data into knowledge, and make sure that that's done with fair practices and in a sustainable fashion, and that we bring and always keep the humans at the kind of center or at the first in our mind as we develop these solutions. Anything else you would like to add to that summarization or next steps? Any final thoughts?
As you mentioned, that the enterprise needs to take action today, right? This is, yes. They cannot wait. I just keep emphasizing, repeat our point. Right. Either you are executive of the company, you need to take action, whether you start some initiative on AI ethical, or you are a technical leader, you need to think about how you build, how you incorporate into the whole process or life cycle there. Right. Or you are a practitioner, like data science or AI engineer. You need to start thinking about and building your ethical practice into your the project life cycle there. So that's my final thought on that.
Perfect, perfect. The opposite of Jim's head in the sand comment from the very beginning. So any other thoughts?
Use the tools, embrace the tools. And as Jim mentioned, just be hands-on. You'll learn and you'll appreciate. You'll appreciate them, and then you'll have a clearer, you know, perspective on AI in general, right? It's not the boogeyman. It's meant to enhance human, human attributes. So my advice is just get your hands on the tools.
All right, Nike, do it.
I'll kind of wrap up with lead from a stance of curiosity. Be continuously curious. Be excited when you get a great answer or outcome, and be excited when you get a lousy answer and outcome, because you've learned the bounds and now you know what you can and can't do.
Yeah. You've got information. Well, thank you very much for your time today. This was a wonderful discussion, and I look forward to more such talks in the future.